Welcome to Oncology Today, CAR T therapy and non-Hodgkin lymphoma edition, a special program focused on recent clinical trial data on the use of this modality in the management of NHL. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Tanya Siddiqui from the City of Hope National Medical Center. In addition to this audio podcast, there's also a video component in this program with the faculty presentation. To begin, I asked Dr. Siddiqui to provide an overview of the field. So let's kind of start with the beginning with CAR T. I'm going to maybe kind of go into some of the things that you went through in your talk in a little bit more depth, beginning with sort of the biology of what CAR T is, how the product is made and delivered. Can you kind of go through that?
Sure. So I explain it to patients like this. So anytime we say, okay, we're going to go ahead with CAR T cell therapy, we have the patient's veins assessed. So arm veins, antecubital veins primarily. The donor center will look at them and tell us, okay, they have good veins. So if they have good veins, they get an IV on both arms. Blood will go out one IV. The apheresis machine will catch all the lymphocytes and the rest of the blood goes back in the other IV. And this process takes about 4 to 6 hours to collect a bag full of lymphocytes that are then sent to where whichever company is going to, or whether it's a City of Hope product or whichever company is going to manufacture the CAR T cells. When the bag of cells gets to that lab, they will collect or take out all the T cells from that product, essentially, and separate it into CD4s and CD8s and start their manufacturing process separately for the two cells right from the beginning. But for everybody else, it's a bag full of T cells that are then transduced to introduce the CAR product using whether lentiviral transduction or retroviral, whatever is being used at that lab. And then these cells are then selected out, grown, expanded, and then frozen and sent back to us. So Kite produces them very quickly in a couple weeks. And we feel like maybe their T cells are a little bit more immature and therefore their side effects are a little bit higher. Whereas the other two companies will take their time and do a little bit more mature T cells, 3 or 4 weeks of manufacturing. So by the time we get the product, it's a month later or so.
Can you talk a little bit more about the biology behind CAR T cells and why they were developed?
So I think it all started out more at the NCI. Different centers have been trying to work with this for a long time, initially using T cells in various forms or tumor material taken right out of, let's say, melanoma and things like that at the NCI, or using CD20 as a target as well because rituximab works so well. I think the reason why CAR T cells have turned out so well and why they were thought of and tried and have turned out so well is because we know that T cells in humans can be very effective in controlling different things, including suppression of tumors and just surveillance against cancers in human bodies. So development of CAR T cells was a way to harness the body's own immune system and use it more effectively to fight a cancer that has already emerged rather than just to prevent cancers from emerging. And I think it all started initially more in melanomas. And then CD19 was found to be such a strong target for B-cell lymphomas, and it's been carrying on since then.
Can you talk about the major products? Maybe we can start out talking about diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and provide sort of a historical perspective on how it evolved in terms of these different products being tested and what was seen.
Sure. So NCI were the first to put out data with their product that was then taken up by Kite and developed as AxiCell. The NCI did different experiments or different phase one studies trying to see what combination of CAR T cell dose and lymphodepletion, whether it was cyclophosphamide, fludarabine and cyclophosphamide, or actually other chemos as well, would work to find that sweet spot to allow the CAR T cells to maximally grow in the body but not cause devastating side effects from the chemo or the CAR T cells. So the very first data that came out in DLBCL was from the NCI. And then when it was taken up by Kite, then the ZUMA-1 trial came about and we were one of the first centers to be participating in that phase one portion of that study years ago. And basically it kind of evolved from there. So we knew from the NCI that you can't use too high a dose of fludarabine and cyclophosphamide because they were causing too much toxicity. People were actually dying from that. So Kite knew to use sort of intermediate, lower doses of, or more like intermediate doses of Flu-Cy. We also knew from the NCI and other centers, Penn, et cetera, that you must have fludarabine in the mix because it really does allow the CAR T cells to activate, grow, divide, and do what they have to do in a better way than if you'd use just cyclophosphamide. And so the phase one portion of ZUMA-1 was really trying to kind of come up with the right cell dose, the right Flu-Cy doses, and then go from there. NCI had also tried in the past, as had UPenn, different cell, not just doses, but schedules. So can you give more than one dose of the cell dose to a patient? Can you break it down? Instead of giving it all in one go, can you break it down and give it over several doses slowly so they have lesser side effects, et cetera, et cetera. And it kind of just in the end panned out to you need 3 days of Flu-Cy with intermediate dosing and you need one dose of cellular product at a reasonable cell dose so it doesn't cause overt CRS and neurotoxicity. And so that's how it all evolved and kind of became standard across the other trials. I think the UPenn and Novartis trials sort of came along around the same time as ZUMA-1. So the precursor to Juliet and the Juliet trials came around the same time as well.
At this point, is there any way to separate these products out? Let's say, for example, in diffuse large B-cell, where I think there's a lot of experience in terms of efficacy and toxicity.
For DLBCL patients, of number one importance, how quickly can we give them their CAR T cells? Number two, what are the side effects? So we know that axi-cel does have higher CRS and neurotoxicity type of side effects. We know how to manage it, but it's very alarming when it happens to patients. You know, it's alarming for us. It's really alarming for the family members because they're like, who is this person? We don't even, you know, it's totally changed personality for a few days. But we get them through it, and thankfully we haven't seen long-standing side effects evolving from that. So if it's a younger patient, stronger patient, we would definitely go for axi-cel. If it's an older patient, frailer patient, we tend to go for T-cell-gen lifileucel because we feel like the side effect profile might be easier on such a patient. So a lot of patients have been treated with these CAR T-cells, and so there's a lot of good data that has been generated. In general, overall response rates seem to be as high as 82% for the ZUMA-1, 73% for Transcend, and 52% for Juliet. And the complete remission rates are in the 40 to 50% range, and these seem to be fairly durable, which is the exciting part for patients.
I have heard people say they think that the CRS neurotoxicity might be somewhat worse with axi-cel. Is that your impression?
Yeah, so it is definitely more prevalent, and the severity of it might also be a little bit more. And I'm not sure entirely why that is. Part of it may have to do with their rapid production, 2.5 weeks. Maybe the T cells are just younger and angrier. I don't know biologically why that is. But yes, we have seen that, and that's what I was saying. So if it's a younger patient, I know they can probably tolerate that a lot better than the older patient. An 80-year-old may not be able to tolerate that higher severity of CRS with hypotension and tachycardia and whatnot as well as a younger patient.
So can you talk a little bit more about the typical, I know there's a lot of individualization, I'm sure, sequence of events once the cells are infused, when you typically see CRS, neurologic syndrome, and what you see?
Sure. So 3 days of Flu-Cy, 2 days of rest, and then the infusion of CAR T cells typically. Depending on which product it is and what the burden of disease in the patients is, generally within the first 3 to 7 days, we start seeing, if we're going to see cytokine release syndrome, we start seeing the CRP and ferritin start climbing, and the patients start developing fevers, sometimes with or without hypotension, sometimes with or without hypoxia, depending on how severe the cytokine release syndrome is. But fevers would be most common. And then it's typically after day 7, maybe after day 5, day 7, that they can have neurotoxicity. So a little bit later, more in the second week, post-CAR T cells. And a lot of times it can be just a headache, which we don't need to do anything about except treat the headache. But if it is higher in severity or higher grade of neurotoxicity, then it could be anything like writing changes, which we test for, memory issues, speech problems, just outright obtundation or really agitation and things like that.
So any new developments in terms of understanding the pathophysiology of the neurologic syndrome, is it thought to be a cytokine release phenomena?
I mean, we know that the CAR T cells do get into everywhere. They can go anywhere. Basically, we found it in CSF. We found it everywhere. And whether or not it's these CAR T cells that are entering the CSF and the brain area through the blood-brain barrier, are those the ones that are then just releasing the cytokines in that location and causing all the havoc with neurotoxicity? That could be one reason. Some people seem to think that maybe it's other white cells that also get in and cause chemokines and cytokine release like granulocytes, etc. It's not really a meningitis picture if you do a spinal tap, if you can keep a patient stable enough to do a spinal tap. Sometimes there are leukoencephalopathy type of pictures seen on MRIs, but usually no changes on MRIs, no changes on EEGs, you know. I think a majority of it is all cytokine related in some fashion.
So just kind of curious if you kind of take a step back and think about where you see CAR T fitting in. There are trials now comparing it to autologous transplant. I'm curious what you think that's going to show right now. Where are you using it and where do you think it's sort of going to land?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Personally, in my own patients, the way that I kind of tell them about the two options, it's hard to do the trials. We are actually not participating in any of these randomized trials between autotransplant and CAR T cells because it's very hard. We know that transplant doesn't work if you have any disease in the body, right? So presumably you have to be in a very near CR to be eligible to go on to that kind of trial because you can't be in a CR to go on to that kind of trial. So for me, for my patients, I tell them, if you are in a complete remission, you should go for a transplant. If you are not in a complete remission, you should go for CAR T cells because the CAR T cells need some antigen, some tumor to be able to detect that, attack that, and grow and do their work. So in my mind, that is the delineation. Disease present, CAR T cells. No disease present, transplant. And that's a simplified version. And beyond that, of course, there are also questions about allo versus auto. At what point do you take somebody with, let's say, Richter's transformation? You wouldn't do an auto on them. You would probably want to take them to an allo transplant if you have a donor, if they're young enough, if they fit enough and they achieve a CR. So go straight to an allo. But if they don't achieve a CR, then you got to go to CAR T cells.
What about the issue of the necessary performance status in order to undergo CAR T? Do these people have to be in the same condition as, for example, an autologous transplant, or can you take older, sicker patients?
We have taken older and sicker patients. Like I said before, the trials, the earlier trials really wanted ECOG 0 to 1, and 1 can be very subjective, as you know. So, you know, for the most part, there's a very wide spectrum of people who have gone on to those trials. Some of them have been very sick, but walking, talking, and clothing themselves and independent in their ADLs and whatnot. The Transplant NHL 001 study did allow ECOG 2 initially, and then as they ramped up to get to their pivotal expansion, they backed down and said only 0 to 1 ECOG. So we have put ECOG 2 patients on that particular trial as well because we feel like their effects are less and patients can tolerate that a lot better. I think the oldest patient I've treated on one of these trials is 83 and did well, got through it fine. Probably the chemo had more side effects than the CAR T cells, to be honest. But again, as you know, even for transplant, there's no real ceiling of age cutoff anymore per se, as long as they're fit and organs are working and things like that. Although we know that the older they get, the tougher it is for them to tolerate high dose, high chemotherapy and transplants. So certainly we feel like CAR T cells are easier, especially T-cell, lifileucel and lysocell are easier to tolerate than axi-cel for the older, frailer population. And in the real world, I mean, if you look at commercial axi-cel, definitely there's much more ECOG-2s that are being given CAR T-cells than were allowed on the trials.
Curious where you think things are right now in terms of the widespread utilization of this therapy, particularly for diffuse large B-cell. I have seen some so-called real-world data that suggests that at least right now things are playing out the way they did in the trials. who actually is giving CAR T right now? What do we know about so-called real world experience?
So there has been probably a lot more real world data seen already with AxiCell because that has been around the longest. Clearly, it's the larger medical centers who have experience with stem cell therapy, cellular therapy, et cetera, who are allowed to use or give commercial CAR T cells as well. And so certainly patients need to be able to get to those centers, just like they would need to be able to get to places where the trials were, but they need to be able to get to those centers and give up a month of their lives, so to speak, once they get the CAR T cells in order to be followed closely. But in reality, you know, it really is. So relapsed refractory DLBCL is the indication, but the FDA is silent on CNS involvement, for instance. We know that ZUMA-1 never treated CNS-involved patients because that was an exclusion criteria. But clearly, we have patients who have secondary CNS involvement in the commercial real world. We are actually giving them CAR T cells. We are giving them AxiCell or T-cell-gen leclucel, and they're doing however they're doing. But we know that the toxicities are not higher in them than in the other patients without CNS disease. So that's just one example. But certainly, there are a lot more patients who don't meet the strict ZUMA-1 criteria who are getting AxiCell as well in the real world. I think there are up to about 60% patients who did not meet the strict ZUMA-1 criteria who got AxiCell commercially.
And do you see this essentially following the transplant model that's already occurred in terms of out into the community? Do you think community-based transplanters are going to be using this therapy?
One can certainly hope so, especially with the newer agent, Lysocell, which has seemingly much, much lower toxicity and easier to manage. And in fact, on the trial, there were, I think, about 15% patients who were treated in the outpatient setting in different centers, so never needed to be admitted for the CAR T cells. Some may have had a fever subsequently and got admitted, but for the most part, were managed in the outpatient setting. And there are more patients on the upcoming trials and the ongoing trials who are now being treated in the outpatient setting with Lysocell. So I think certainly if that can be established as a safe practice and people have adequate training in how to manage quickly the CRS and neurotoxicity type side effects, I don't see why not, as long as it's a big enough center or big enough practice that can certainly provide emergency care if and when needed.
I'm curious the kind of questions you get from community-based transplanters. What are some of the issues and things that they're curious to know about sort of in preparation for that move, so to speak?
Unfortunately, because of COVID, we haven't had too many of these discussions this year because we haven't met too many people this year or gone to conferences this year. But I think people are apprehensive in the community. They've heard a lot about the CRS and neurotoxicity type side effects, and especially with ZUMA-1, and there were like 3 deaths, and I think they're apprehensive. So I think it'll take a lot of education and training and teaching to get them to a place where they'll be comfortable.
Can you comment a little bit about mantle cell and CAR T?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so as part of ZUMA-2, the first product that was tried was AxiCell for mantle cell lymphoma. And I had a patient on that initial, there were just very few patients trying AxiCell. He did great in the sense that he had very refractory disease and achieved a complete remission that was durable and lasting. But 6 months later, he unfortunately died of something else, some neuro-related event, but it wasn't CAR T-cell related necessarily. And then so I think what they saw in that first group of patients with AxiCell was that there was way, even though the responses were super high, like almost 100%, there was also almost 100% like toxicity. And so they adjusted or amended their product to come up with the X19 product, in which manufacturing is a little bit different so that it's not AxiCell anymore. The KTE X19 CAR T cells is a nuanced CD19 targeting product, which is different than AxiCell. And so this is the one that has just received FDA approval for mantle cell lymphoma. And it's based on this phase 2 trial, a multicenter trial with relapsed refractory mantle cell lymphoma patients who had all failed or progressed after or had been exposed to prior BTK inhibitors. 74 patients were enrolled, 68 treated. The cell dose was the same as on the ZUMA-1 trial, 2 times 10 to the 6 CAR positive T cells per kg. there were a bunch of bad actors on the study, not only that 68% had been refractory to BTK inhibitors, but also 31% had blastoid morphology, 56% had intermediate or high-risk MIPI scores, and a majority of patients had actually had more than three lines of prior therapy. Despite all that, and I think we all know that relapsed mantle cell lymphoma is not a disease to bring to heal easily. Once they relapse, it's very hard to bring them back into a remission or control their disease, and it's very hard to get them to an allotransplant because we can never get them into remission. But regardless, with this product, KTEX-19, the overall response rate in this very bad acting set of patients was 93% with 67% complete remissions. And at 12-month follow-up, estimated PFS was 61%, OS 83%. And they've had toxicity with this as well, but it's been manageable and they've shown excellent results. I personally have put a lot of patients on the Transcend NHL-001 lysocell study, which also allows mantle cell lymphoma as a separate cohort. And I've seen excellent results in mantle cell patients thus far. I mean, I've had one lady who came to me from Greece because her daughter lives here, and 2-3 years ago, and she's still in a complete remission. And this was after failing ibrutinib, et cetera. There are currently many, many more patients who are being treated with mantle cell lymphoma in the expansion phase. And we have a bunch of those patients on there. And they're all doing very well, thankfully. Bulky disease, they get complete remissions as quickly as 1 month after CAR T cells. And we need to see if it's durable. But I'm very impressed, actually. Yeah. And now with the new product, the X19 product that is commercially available, I think it's a very good option. We just have to be mindful about the toxicities. We just have to be careful about that.
At this point, if you could use it at any point in time in mantle cell, when would you use it?
The first shot in mantle cell is sort of the shot that'll get you the longest time without needing treatment again. So once they relapse, it's very hard to put them back in a remission and get them to an allotransplant. The way that the study has studied it is obviously for people who have failed more than one or two lines of therapy, maximum five were allowed on the trial, but all of them had to have failed ibrutinib or a BTK inhibitor. And so I think once we know that they're failing a novel agent, second line or more, the earlier the line of therapy after relapse, I would say, is better to give CAR T cells a shot so that they're not super sick by the time they come to us for CAR T cell therapy. So try that first before you go on to venetoclax and other things. If they failed a BTK inhibitor or they are on a BTK inhibitor and they're not responding great or they're starting to progress, send them quickly before you give them too many other things and make them frailer.
Any patient with mantle cell that you've treated who did well or that you might want to comment on?
Yeah, so for lysocell, for instance, on that trial, we've had a number of patients. And the longest I can remember one being in a remission still was this lady from Greece who had failed multiple lines of therapy, including ibrutinib, came to us for CAR T cell therapy on the trial, did extremely well, had some infections, but then all those have resolved. And now she's, I think, 3 years out living in Greece and doing well, just as an example. But there are many more. Like, we have other patients on the lysocell trial with mantle cell who are also doing extremely well. One patient with extremely bulky disease who was just progressing too rapidly got lysocell, and a month later, he has no sign of disease whatsoever. So hopefully that'll be durable for him.
Let's talk about CLL and what we know about that and CAR T.
CLL is interesting. The very first patients that were mentioned receiving CD19-directed CAR T cells back in 2010 were CLL patients, and then the focus entirely shifted to DLBCL for this last decade somehow, and now we're coming back to CLL. And CLL is interesting in that it is an indolent lymphoma, so we know that people can live a long time with just cycling or sequencing different pills. And when you have pills as an option, it's very hard to sell an IV or an intensive therapy to that patient, especially even transplant, you know, allogeneic stem cell transplant, as a curative option. So certainly CAR T cells are much easier to get through than allogeneic stem cell transplant. Juno Therapeutics has used the GAR17 product in this Transcend CLL004 study that is really showing some amazing results. Patients needed to have relapsed or refractory CLL. The majority of patients had advanced stage disease and high risk features. The overall response rate of the 22 evaluable patients was as high as 81.5%. with 45.5% complete remissions. And in the subset of 9 patients who had double refractory disease, 67% achieved a complete remission despite having failed both ibrutinib and venetoclax with the CD19 targeting CAR T cell. And in the set of 20 patients who were evaluable for MRD, 75% in the blood and 65% in the bone marrow achieved undetectable MRD. And in the subset of 9 patients who had failed both ibrutinib and venetoclax, very high rates of undetectable MRD at 87% and 75% respectively in the blood and bone marrow at a median follow-up of 11 months. I can tell you I have a lot of these patients. Vast majority of them are remaining in remission 2-3 years out from their CAR T cells with undetectable MRD. We feel that if somebody has porous features maybe and is progressing after the first or second novel agent available, then certainly that is a very good time to try CAR T cells in, because then you're running out of options essentially. And before they get too sick and not respond to anything, better to get them CAR T cells and see if they can achieve a long-term remission with that and maybe never even need treatment again, potentially. So I think it's come a long way. It is going to keep going a long way. And I'm hoping that for this incurable disease of CLL, we can ultimately say, hey, I think we're curing some of these people if we can go 10 years or more in remission.
So as you think through the options, younger patient, high-risk disease, like you said, maybe progressing through one or two therapies, how do you decide between CAR T and, you know, some of the transplant options?
I always offer CAR T first. Right now, it has to be on a trial. Maybe in the future, I don't know how long it'll take, but maybe it'll be an FDA-approved option for patients in the upcoming years. But I always offer CAR T cells first because I feel like that is an easier treatment to go through and has no sort of long-term side effects like allogeneic stem cell transplantation can have. There is a treatment-related mortality with allos. There is GVHD, real risks with allos. So you can trade one chronic disease for really bad other chronic disease. Whereas with CAR T cells, you have up to 75% chance of undetectable MRD, long-term remissions. Now patients are 3.5 years out. Of course, they need to continue to be followed. And so for young patients, I think that is attractive to see, can you potentially cure somebody without having to make them go through an allo transplant?
What about the patient with follicular lymphoma, marginal zone lymphoma? Where do you see CAR T fitting in now? I know there's a couple of trials that we've seen press releases on, the ALARA phase 2 trial of TIS, and then there was the ZUMA-5 trial of AxiCell. Can you comment on that and where you see things heading with follicular lymphoma?
Just to talk a little bit about the follicular lymphoma study that is still ongoing, it's a Tisagenlecleucel, 97 patients who are still being treated. And the company has reported positive results at the interim analysis. We haven't heard about any new safety signals. I know at City of Hope, we've put a few patients on the study, have done extremely well. And so we're all looking forward to some good results from this study as well. I'll just comment on the ZUMA-5 indolent lymphoma trial using AxiCell. They're looking to enroll 160 patients with relapsed refractory disease who progressed after two or more lines of prior therapy for follicular or marginal zone lymphoma. The FDA has accepted their BLA for this product in these diseases, so we'll see how quickly they can get potential FDA approval for commercial use of AxiCell in these diseases as well. So CD19 targeting for all B-cell lymphomas is turning out to be a bit of a home run, especially with these products that already have done a lot of trials in aggressive lymphomas. So now everybody's turning to these indolent lymphomas, right? So CLL we talked about, but then follicular and marginal zone. There is a need in indolent lymphomas. We have so many options of less intensive, less invasive, like just take a pill versus go through this whole month of more intensive therapy. But the potential of cure is what will be the trick for these patients. So if you failed a couple of lines of therapy and you're getting beyond like the first novel agent that you tried, let's say, and you relapsed or refractory to a novel agent or two, your options are going to start getting limited. And instead of going on to another phase one trial with another new pill or new injection or whatever, try CAR T cells, because if you have a remission, a complete remission, it is very likely to be a durable one. And you may not need treatment again for a long, long, long time, if at all. And that is the beauty and the hope and the holy grail that we're trying to achieve with CAR T cells in indolent lymphomas as well as aggressive lymphomas.
Do you see any myths or misperceptions about CAR T, both in patients as well as in the referring physicians?
I think in the earlier days, people were under the impression that everybody responds beautifully to CAR T cells. So there was a lot of disappointments when half the patients, unfortunately, with aggressive lymphoma, like there will be half who won't respond. So I always try to tell patients and their physicians, like, try it, because if it works, it works extremely well. So the goal is, if it works, that's where we have to get better at it. So if it works, it works extremely well. But beyond that, I mean, I think there are some referring physicians who think that it's more of a last-ditch effort. So they try every last treatment before they refer. And we're trying to get them to understand then refer them earlier in the second-line setting so that they're not all beaten up and performance status-wise too weak to be able to undergo CAR T-cell therapy. So it's not a myth, but a reality, actually, that if some patients have, from prior chemo, et cetera, too few lymphocytes in their system, then it's harder for us to manufacture CAR T cells. But again, with lysocell, they have not really had that issue, thankfully. So the other products will always say, okay, your absolute lymphocyte count needs to be above a certain amount for us to be able to manufacture cells, whereas lysocell doesn't have that cutoff. So I don't want referring physicians to worry about the lymphocyte count too much. I would prefer if they just send patients over for evaluations and we worry about whether or not they're good enough to go to CAR T cells.
Any correlation between side effects in CAR T, cytokine release, neurologic syndrome, and treatment benefit? Any way to predict who's going to get more side effects? Do younger patients with better immune systems get more side effects?
No, the younger patients may not get more side effects necessarily. I think we've seen that people with higher tumor burdens get more side effect because there's certainly more fight going on in their bodies. So we've seen that people with lower LDHs and lower SPDs, like sum of product of diameters of their tumors, so lower bulk of disease, will definitely have fewer side effects. So I think it has to do with tumor burden more than anything else. By that token, we always try to advise referring physicians, don't wait till your patient has exploding disease to send them, because just like with transplant, when you're in a complete remission, you'll have the best chance of having a very good outcome with transplant. Similarly with CAR T cells, if you have lesser volume disease, we can treat anybody, even with bulky disease. But if you have lesser volume disease, you have a better chance of tolerating it better and having a better outcome overall.
So you mentioned COVID before, and I'm curious what happened when COVID got started, what's going on right now in your place?
Right. So I think nationally and at our place, we ramped down a lot of our CAR T cell and transplant admissions, trials, because it was logistically very difficult to keep everybody safe. How do we have the leukapheresis staff come in and the nursing staff and the research staff? And here we are trying to tell people to work from home and not expose themselves, et cetera. And then patients themselves, it was very hard to figure out who would be their caregiver if the caregivers go going out into the community and bringing back infections. Like, how do you control all that? So for a good, like, I want to say April, May, almost June, 3 months, I think we ramped down quite a bit with our trials and our standard of care transplants and CAR T cells. But now, as of the summer, we have ramped back up again and we are slowly getting back to full capacity. I mean, inpatient, we started with admitting everybody. We're still not doing outpatient CAR T cells just because of the caregiver issue. Like, we don't know, you know, it might be easier for them to catch COVID outside if they were coming and going and then bring it with them to the outpatient center, you know, if they're coming and going regularly. So we just put them in the hospital for a couple of weeks and just manage them inpatient so far. But we're ramping up our outpatient autos as well, and we're going to start doing outpatient CAR T cells soon as well.
Can you comment on so-called off-the-shelf CAR T? And there's allo products and bispecifics, et cetera. Can you talk about what's being looked at in that regard and where you see it heading?
I don't know a lot about the off-the-shelf allo CARs, and just because I haven't been part of the trials at City of Hope, but we have the trials and we have patients who go on those studies as well. It is very convenient. If it can be shown that it is as effective and as durable as CD19 CARs have been, the autologous personalized product, then there's nothing like it. It's a beautiful thing. You pick one off the shelf, you give it, and you cure a patient. Like, that's all you want, right? Concerns for GVHD were raised with these allo CARs. We haven't really seen a lot of that. I don't think that that's a big worry at this point. But efficacy and other side effects, of course, we still need to look at. So it's certainly convenient because it takes a long time and a lot of logistical. It's like at one point, I remember because I had so many CAR T-cell trials running, and I would tell my colleagues, like, I feel like I'm some kind of a flight director or something in the control tower. It's so stressful because it's like, you have to get them the slot and you have to get the patients in line. You don't want to jump anyone jumping the line. And it was just crazy. So that's very difficult to have patients leukapheresis, wait for the manufacturing, give them back their cells. And it's convenient if you just take it off the shelf. So that'll be nice. And it's a cellular product. So the goal of cure is still there because those cells might be able to live forever and create some kind of memory, maybe. The bispecific antibodies is a different issue. I don't see those as a curative option necessarily, just because of the fact that they're not cells, living cells. But I heard somebody say that all, with the CAR T cells, the beauty is that we think that it goes and gets every last cancer B cell, even maybe the cancer stem cell, which expresses CD19. So maybe that's why we're having these durable remissions with just one treatment cycle. Maybe we don't even need memory CAR T cells to stay there forever. Whereas with BiTE antibodies, bispecifics, I don't know if necessarily that'll happen, but if it does, then maybe we can see some cures on that too. I know they're having good responses. I just don't know how durable they are. So I think we have to wait and see.
Any comments on combining things with CAR T? I've heard about ibrutinib. I think I've heard about checkpoint inhibitors. I'm sure there's a lot of other strategies. Anything there that you find interesting?
Yeah, for sure. So I think liso-cel by itself in CLL looks great, but all the other products, JCAR14 is the precursor to liso-cel at Seattle, their own product. That didn't do so well on its own, so they had to combine it with ibrutinib, and now it looks much, much better with ibrutinib. Same with UPenn, like their product with ibrutinib looks much better than their product by itself, CTL019 or 119 it's called, etc. I think adding ibrutinib in CLL is certainly being tried and is showing not just the efficacy might be better because it enhances or strengthens the T cells, but it seems to limit the CRS somewhat as well. So they're having even fewer CRS events with ibrutinib on board. In aggressive lymphomas, in DLBCL especially, the platform trial is currently underway. So I have that at City of Hope, and we're enrolling patients on that. That is the liso-cel plus something. And they have many different arms on that trial, like a platform. So you have ibrutinib on one arm, added to the liso-cel. You have a checkpoint inhibitor, IDO inhibitor, many different things that are being added, even a cereblon inhibitor, et cetera, adding to CAR T cells to see will any of them produce better responses and outcomes in these aggressive lymphoma patients. So I think time will tell, but you're right. There are a lot of things being tried that make sense. I can tell you anecdotally, the only Richter's patient that has done well for me with CAR T cells in the long term was somebody who was on that platform trial, and we gave her liso-cel plus durvalumab, so a PD-L1 antibody, and she never relapsed after like multiple relapses and multiple lines of therapy in the past. She never relapsed again with her Richter's for 2 years later, but she died of MDS and fungal pneumonia 2 years after the fact. So that combination was good for Richter's, for instance, in that one patient.
What's your vision of the immune effects of BTK inhibitors and the reason why, other than anti-tumor efficacy, as you were suggesting, maybe there's some kind of immune synergy? What does ibrutinib do? I know you understood it. It's like approved for graft versus host disease, right?
Exactly. It has T cell effects in that it'll curb the T regulatory cells that can cause a lot of the cytokine release syndrome and GVHD, but it also strengthens the inherent CD4s and CD8s T cells so that the thought is you produce a better CAR T cell product if you're on somebody's on ibrutinib through leukapheresis. And so the strength of your CAR T cell will be better. And so it'll perform more efficaciously. But at the same time, the side effects might be limited.
So one final question. Kind of curious how you envision the CRS of COVID-19 and how that compares to the CRS you see with CAR T. We have seen BTK inhibitors used to treat COVID and people don't even have cancer. Any comments about that whole area of investigation?
I don't think there's a lot of data. I know there are studies that have opened and they're trying to see if it'll work. So anecdotally, there might be cases that seem to have responded well. So it works in GVH. It's probably going to work in COVID as well. We at our center have a study in COVID that we're trying to use tocilizumab in by the same token from what we've learned in CAR T cells and CRS. And tocilizumab seems to work very well in curtailing that or breaking that cycle. So we're trying to see if that'll work in COVID-related CRS as well. I think time will tell, or the studies will tell. I'm a little skeptical. I don't know if it'll work for everybody, but I'm hopeful that it might work. And I think it'll be great if it does, because we have so many BTK inhibitors out there that can be used.
Can you talk about your three cases to illustrate how these therapies are used clinically?
So the first patient was a 58-year-old man when I first met him. He had a history of aortic regurgitation and ASD and had undergone surgery and repair for that in 2010. He was a marathon runner. He finished running a half marathon in 2014 and developed progressive back pain. Unfortunately, an MRI showed retroperitoneal lymphadenopathy at that time, and he underwent a biopsy, which confirmed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, stage 2 disease at that time, I believe. He was treated with R-CHOP chemotherapy initially, but after 2-3 cycles was noted to have a drop in his ejection fraction. So he was switched to RCEOP, which basically takes out the doxorubicin component and switches it for etoposide. He had 3 more cycles of that. Unfortunately, his post-treatment scan did not show a complete remission, it seems. He had some lighting up on the PET scan in the GI tract, and he went away on a vacation before having this addressed. And when he came back, he started having a GI bleed. Endoscopy and EUS was done in Feb of 2015. Biopsies again showed DLBCL in that region. He was given a couple cycles of rice with the goal of taking him to autologous stem cell transplant, which was done in May of 2015. However, I think his PET scan right after auto may have shown remission, but he quickly progressed again in the GI tract. And this time he bled again and had to undergo a major surgery to resect a lot of parts to control the bleed and also to take out a lot of tumor. As he was recovering from this major surgery and just getting back to his running and weightlifting and things like that, he was noted to have disease progression again. And so he was referred to me at City of Hope for CAR T-cell trial consideration, because at that time there was no commercial CAR T-cell available. ECOG performance status was 1. He was looking fit and healthy, essentially, for somebody who had just undergone such a major surgery. We put him on the ZUMA-1 trial, which was the only one available at that time. He collected cells in Feb of 2016, had his Flu/Cy chemotherapy in early March, and received his CAR T cells on March 7, 2016. He did have grade 1 cytokine release syndrome with fevers, but grade 3 neurotoxicity with complete sort of, you know, not behaving like himself and not following commands, not recognizing people, not even speaking actually for a few days, and immediately was put on dexamethasone after tocilizumab. All the symptoms resolve in probably 3, 4, 5 days. We tapered off the steroids. He was sent home. His day 28 PET scan showed a complete remission, and he's never looked back. Thankfully, he has never relapsed again, and he's been able to go and get more definitive heart surgery subsequently. He lives in Southern California, as you can imagine, and he goes skiing in the morning and down to the beach in the evening in winter. So he's living a very full and healthy life. He runs 3 restaurants, and so he's seen his kids get married, and he's very, very happy, obviously. This is like now, what, 4.5 years later. The next patient, and this is just one example of many that we put on the Transcend NHL 001 study, 66-year-old Hispanic lady who came to us from the San Diego area, stage 4 marginal zone lymphoma, was initially treated in 2011, came back every couple of years or so, got different lines of therapy for it, including RCVP, bendamustine and rituximab, maintenance rituximab, etc. And then she broke out in 2018 with subcutaneous nodules that were biopsied and shown to be sort of transformed into diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. She was treated with R-CHOP chemotherapy and unfortunately could not get to a transplant because she never achieved a remission. In fact, had more lesions developed. So she was given rice for a couple of cycles and then sent to us for CAR T-cell evaluation. We put her on the Transcend NHL 001 study. She underwent leukapheresis in October 2018. She did need a cycle of our GemOx to prevent the subcutaneous nodules from just progressing too rapidly. And unfortunately, the chemo didn't really help the nodules to regress, but at least she didn't progress too rapidly because of the bridging chemotherapy. She received a Flu/Cy lymphodepletion, followed a couple of days later by her lysocell CAR T-cells in early November of 2018. Did not have any overt CRS or neurotoxicity side effects, was sent home after a week or so being in the hospital, maybe even a couple of weeks just for monitoring reasons. And a day 28 scan showed near CR with a very small focus of SUV of 4.2 above the left eyelid, which is where one of her lymphoma lesions was, but everything else had cleared up. And she actually went into a complete remission by her 6-month scan, and has stayed in her remission since then, working full-time, living a full life, enjoying her grandkids and things like that. And then lastly, case number 3 is a 67-year-old man with CLL who had pretty high-risk features of his disease, ZAP70 positive, unmutated IGHV, deletion 11Q, and then later on, deletion 17P was acquired as well. He was diagnosed way back when in 2006. Because of his high-risk features, he was treated at San Diego as well, and because of his high-risk features, I guess he was never really given standard chemoimmunotherapy at that time. He was treated with lenalidomide and rituximab, subsequently ofatumumab, high-dose methylprednisolone, and then ultimately ibrutinib in 2014, but he had to stop it after a year because he got terrible rashes with blisters all over his body, thought to be related to ibrutinib. And then he developed very painful, progressive lymphadenopathy, pretty bulky disease as part of his disease progression, went on to venetoclax for a bit, had a partial response, but had to come off a year or so later because he progressed again. And then he came to us for CAR T-cell evaluation because at that time we still have the Transcend CLL-004 study ongoing. So he was actually the first patient nationally who was treated with lysocell on the CLL trial, underwent leukapheresis in January of 2018. We had to use idelalisib and I think it was ofatumumab and prednisone to control his painful, massive sort of lymphadenopathy symptoms while the CAR T-cells were being manufactured. And even though the pain would respond to the prednisone, his lymph nodes never really shrank significantly. And so when he went in for his Flu/Cy conditioning chemotherapy followed by CAR T-cells in late January of 2018, it took him about a week or 10 days to start seeing shrinking of his lymph nodes and improvement in his disease per se. But along the way, he had fever and chills with Rigers, as expected in CLL patients, starting about 6 days post-cells. And then this kind of progressed on more onto hypotension, etc., requiring tocilizumab. By day 10, he had developed tumor lysis syndrome as well, given his bulky lymphadenopathy and ongoing fevers and hypotension. He also developed grade 3 neurotoxicity, needed to be transferred to the ICU, but never intubated. He received respiracase, Keppra, dexamethasone, and mental status and other symptoms all started improving. Subsequently, by about day 16 or so, we started tapering down his steroids. By the time he actually left the hospital, he was a good 3 weeks out post-cells. So he had a pretty dramatic shaky course, but he had a lot of disease as well. And his day 28 scan showed that all that bulky lymphadenopathy had essentially pretty much gone away, except maybe a residual spleen. at 15 centimeters, and maybe some small pelvic lymphadenopathy at maybe 3 centimeters or something like that. His bone marrow showed MRD positive CR at that time, but at the 6-month mark, his bone marrow became MRD undetectable. We still call him a PR because he still has some residual splenomegaly that never really went away, probably due to scarring, and some residual small lymphadenopathy in the pelvic sidewall area that never really went away, but probably again because of scarring. He's done very well. He's had knee replacement surgeries, etc. over time. He's stayed in a remission per se, never needed CLL treatment again, but he does need regular IVIG infusions because his IgG levels tend to dip down and, you know, he's had a couple bouts of pneumonia and whatnot. So we do need to be mindful of this particular side effect of not just CLL and lymphoma, but also CAR T-cell therapy targeting B-cells because they can have prolonged hypogammaglobulinemia that needs to be addressed.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Siddiqui, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today, CAR T Therapy and Non-Hodgkin Lymphoma Edition.